good afternoon. You all quieted down so nicely there. I'm sorry we're late getting started. Representative Gingrey is en route, and we're going to go ahead with the event and loop back to him when he arrives. Thank you all for coming. Hopefully everyone has picked up a copy of the initial perspectives report that the HASC Worlds and Missions panel has put together. We're very happy to have Representative Cooper here today, who is the chairman of that panel, and is going to tell us a little bit about the HASC's view on roles and missions and the panel's report here, and hopefully also where they're planning to go with this panel endeavor. And we've also got Representative Gingrey, who is the ranking member on that panel, who will be joining us. We have commenting on the report and also more generally on the issue of roles and missions or DOD reform and interagency reform. Pick the framework that works for you, if you will. We have Michelle Flournoy here from the Center for New American Security, and we have James Kitfield from the National Journal. I'm going to do a very brief intro for each of them now, and then we're going to go down the line first with Representative Cooper presenting on the report, and we'll have plenty of time at the end for questions and answers. And we will have mics for that, so please do wait for the microphone and state your name and your affiliation. First, it's my pleasure to introduce Representative Cooper from Tennessee. He's a Rhodes Scholar. He has a JD from Harvard Law. He was the congressman from the 4th Congressional District from 1983 to 1995, but he was elected to his second stint in Congress in 2002 and now represents the 5th District of Tennessee. He serves on the Armed Services Budget and Oversight and Government Reform Committees, and in 2007 he was named as the chairman of this panel. Sitting to his left is Michelle Flournoy. Michelle is the president of the Center for New American Security. She was previously a senior advisor here at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, and it's our great fortune that she continues her affiliation with CSIS. She was before that a distinguished research professor at the National Defense University, and in the 1990s was dual-hatted as the Principal Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Strategy and Threat Reduction, and also the Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Strategy. Michelle has a BA from Harvard University and an MLit from Oxford. And then to her left is James Kitfield. He's the National Security and Foreign Affairs Correspondent from the National Journal. He has written on defense, national security, and foreign policy issues from Washington, D.C. for nearly two decades. He has written in 2005 the book War and Destiny, How the Bush Revolution in Foreign and Military Affairs Redefined American Power. And in 1995, he wrote Prodigal Soldiers, How the Generation of Officers Born of Vietnam Revolutionized the American Style of War. He has many awards, which I am not going to be able to list all right now, but most recently in 2004, the Military Reporters and Editors Association awarded him their first prize in excellence for his coverage of the Iraq War. He is a graduate of the University of Georgia, which, once we have Representative Gingrey here, I think makes three Southerners and Michelle as a California girl, so to speak, on the panel, and we'll see how that bias plays out in any way. I'm interested to see. So I will hold off on introducing Representative Gingrey until he actually arrives. So with that, let me pass the mic over to Representative.
Thank you so much, Kathleen, and thanks to everyone at CSIS for hosting this forum. I'm grateful for CSIS work over the years. They've contributed so much to our country. I'm particularly grateful for their Beyond Goldwater Nichols effort, which I know was very helpful to our Roles and Missions panel. Pleased to be with Michelle here today, who is a key contributor to the Beyond Goldwater Nichols effort. And of course, it's a pleasure to be with James. Let me describe briefly the slender 91-page booklet, which was just released today. I hope you'll dip into it. It's very easy reading. It's a user-friendly document. We're trying to update some congressional procedures so that not only does it have pictures and short articles and readable prose, it's also an open source document. We are genuinely soliciting your input because all we're doing with this is planting a few seeds. The scope of this project is so great that we need all the help we can get. We want your wisdom. I've never served in the military. I don't even have a military base in my district or a defense contractor. I'm pure on these issues, the only virgin in the room. So it's a good faith effort, which thankfully was started by Ike Skelton, who's a remarkable individual. He's not only the HASC chairman, but he was the key junior congressman in the Goldwater Nichols reform effort that started in 1982, 4 years before the bill was passed. When he heard General David Jones' testimony, when apparently no other member of the HASC did. General Jones was in the last 5 months of his tenure, second tour as chairman of the Joint Chiefs, but in a budget hearing, he dared raise some of these fundamental issues. He faced the wrath of all of the services, the entire Reagan administration, and still he proceeded. So one of the things we're looking for is not only good input from you, but a maverick four-star who may be willing to risk the remainder of his career on championing needed reform ideas. As Phil will stress as well, this book has nothing to do with the Iraq War or the Afghan War or anything like that. It's a forward-looking project. See how we can keep America number one. That is our complete bipartisan goal. And it was joined in this effort not only by Phil Gingrey, but by Rick Larson, Mike Conaway, Kirsten Gillibrand, Jeff Davis, and Admiral Joe Sestak, six of the more remarkable members of the HASC and members who are likely to be there for a long time. So even though the panel's duration was only 6 months, this is quite an informal effort, and deliberately so, because as a panel instead of a subcommittee, we were able to cross all jurisdictional lines. We were able not to have hearings, but small seminars with distinguished witnesses, which are actually much more efficient learning opportunities. So in this, in many ways, we're trying to update the procedures of the Congress. As you'll see in here, one of the key articles is reforming Congress itself, because of all the 9/11 Commission recommendations, the one thing we failed to do is to prevent the Homeland Security Department, for example, from having to testify to 86 different committees and subcommittees in Congress. So there is so much work to be done. We divided the task into three parts. One, interagency rivalry, Pentagon, State, CIA, NSC. Second level would be Pentagon-wide questions like procurement, role of the JROC, things like that. Third level would be the traditional concept of roles and missions, which tends, unfortunately, to be toward inter-service rivalry. We hope to keep that at a minimum, or at least the bluffing and the posturing and the pettiness of some of the past disputes, because our challenge is to keep America number one and probably on not tightened budgets, because you know you'll see the Democrats this year in the Democratic budget giving every penny that President Bush requested. But if we are facing recession, the times are going to be tougher, and we'll all need to reexamine our priorities to make sure we're doing the right thing for our servicemen and women. Phil, come on up, man. I was just filibustering until you got here.
You can do it.
No, I'm not as good as a senator. I'm not as good as a senator. They're the professionals. We're amateurs.
That's true. That is true.
So Phil and I worked well together on this project. Every member of the panel contributed at least one essay. And as you'll see, we also took some material from the public domain. And we tried to include some controversial stuff. I was uncontroversial until you got here. But articles like the famous Yingling piece, which advocates cashiering basically a couple of hundred generals. Pieces on the need for a more robust cyber warfare capability. A piece in here about the role of the National Guard, which is very sensitive to most members of Congress and senators. Other pieces in here I think that you'll take a particular interest in. Let me end on this note. To us, the first rule of war is, of course, to understand the nature of the enemy. That's simple and clear. Everybody learns it. But when it comes to learning the language or the culture or the environment that our soldiers are placed in, we sometimes haven't done the job that our soldiers deserve. So we want to stress that, too, and we include a number of quick pieces to help focus the attention of the average American and perhaps the average man or woman in a uniform on the need to be more effective in that regard. So why don't I stop there and turn it over to my esteemed colleague, the ranking member on the panel on Roles and Missions, Phil Gingrey.
Let me introduce Representative Gingrey. We're very happy you're able to join us today. Representative Gingrey was elected to Congress in 2002. He represents Georgia's 11th District. He serves on the Armed Services Committee. And as I said earlier, he is the ranking member on the Roles and Missions panel and is also the ranking member on the Science Subcommittee on Technology and Innovation. During his previous terms in Congress, Representative Gingrey also served on the Rules Committee and the Committee on Education and the Workforce. He has a Bachelor of Science degree from Georgia Tech, and I was noting earlier that there are three Southerners, two Georgia graduates here on the panel. And Perhaps most importantly, he is a graduate of the Medical College of Georgia and has delivered more than 5,000 babies. So with that, Representative Gingrey, perhaps you can deliver the interagency.
Kathleen, thank you. I really appreciate that warm introduction. Like Chairman Cooper, I very much appreciate the invitation from CSIS to come here today and discuss the recommendations of the House Armed Services Committee panel on roles and missions and the way ahead for this very important, if often controversial, issue. It's obviously it's obvious from the interest generated that a reexamination of the roles and missions of the military services is long past due. 1947, 1986, and here we are, 2008, as a considered reevaluation of the roles, missions, and capabilities of the rest of the federal government. A corresponding restructuring of congressional oversight is something that Jim has talked about maybe already in his opening remarks, and I think that's very important. As Chairman Cooper stated, the roles and missions panel report, it's not meant to provide answers to these difficult questions. I wish we had them today. That would be nice, but we don't. But rather to at least begin the discussion by suggesting unorthodox approaches for consideration. Under Chairman Cooper's leadership, our bipartisan panel of seven members of Congress met with a broad range of experts in military, international, and government affairs during our six-month charter. Now, Jim may have already mentioned the members of the Roles and Missions ad hoc panel, but we had four Democrats, including our chairman, and three Republicans, and I think every one of those members are deep thinkers and have done a lot of hard work during this six-month period of time. As Jim said, each has contributed at least an article, if not more, to the report. And I think these are very serious-minded, not playing politics members of the House Armed Services Committee, which I'm very proud to be a part of. We learned a great deal. We heard many good ideas. There was certainly no consensus on a solution or even a consensus on what needed to be fixed. So rather than attempt to clearly define the problem, much less prescribe a solution, the panel chose to offer a range of views on options to Chairman Skelton, Ranking Member Hunter, and the public in the hopes of generating serious debate that will lead to substantive changes. So this event today is exactly the sort of discussion we had hoped to stimulate by our report. Some in the audience may wonder at our restraint in not providing specific recommendations. While members of Congress are too often eager to stipulate solutions, we do it all the time, without fully understanding the problem, our group was much more deliberate. And I'm thankful for that. We quickly realized that we were faced with a broad, government-wide, not just military, challenge of longstanding, which will require equally broad consensus in Congress and across the administration to address. So in that vein, we chose to identify gaps and issues for consideration rather than dictate solutions. We believe that to be the more responsible and productive approach, with the Department of Defense about to engage on a comprehensive roles and missions review as required by our committee in the Defense Authorization Act of 2008. That language specifically is in there. In fact, Jim and I will be meeting with the administration tomorrow from the Department of Defense to discuss exactly the way forward in regard to that report. And, of course, we've got a brand-new administration coming in less than a year. The panel also recognized that substantial congressional oversight changes are in order for any executive branch reforms to succeed. It's clear to me that part of the difficulties experienced by the Department of Homeland Security lie in the splintered congressional oversight it receives across many different authorizing committees. How many, Jim, did you say?
I think 85 or 86.
85. So I believe our group of seven members is capable of crafting credible solutions to these roles and missions issues within the military service and across the government, but it isn't possible for seven members of one committee to craft politically sustainable solutions in a six-month effort. So we did what we thought was best to get the debate started and advance the cause. Three things became clear. Change is needed, change will be controversial, and difficult change requires substantial political will. The one reform I think is most needed is developing a surge capacity within the Department of State. The numbers of Foreign Service offices and USAID personnel is so limited that there's no way we can fill authorized spaces and embassies around the world, much less to go ahead and expand our effort when we face an international challenge. There's no Foreign Service National Guard or Reserve, as an example, if you will, to move in behind the military and help reestablish municipal services and basic local and regional government in a ravaged nation. Trained people simply do not exist to meet that need, and there's no structure for them to join, even if they did exist. I, for that reason, wholeheartedly endorse the present proposal that we establish a robust civilian reserve corps, CRC, to be available to deploy overseas to help our nations in times of crisis, rather than continuing to leave this role to the military. And the military does a great job, but in many instances, there's some other job that they should be doing that they're tasked for and skilled at doing. The armed forces do an incredible job, as I say, but there is a cost to readiness and military families. Additionally, soldiers are not experts in nation building. The mere presence of their proud uniforms raises the specter of an unwelcome American military occupation. It would be far better to have skilled civilians performing these roles as part of the restructured Department of State that accepts and values these operational missions in addition to their traditional diplomatic strategic focus in foreign capitals. So creation of a civilian reserve corps, and that was my chapter in the report, will lead to other changes, such as the need for an operational link between state and defense, leading to coordination challenges across other departments, including the Office of Director of the National Intelligence, Department of Homeland Security. We need to think through whether this coordination should be done on an enduring basis by executive agency vested in a single department, as is done now, or whether the National Security Council should adopt an operational role or develop an operational sub-element. All of these approaches have disadvantages. However, I think the process has already begun with the Secretary of Defense's recent major speech suggesting a greater role and more robust funding and staffing for the State Department. Obviously, these issues are difficult and emotional within the military services, within the Cabinet, and in Congress. Again, I want to commend my chairman, Jim Cooper, on his leadership of this panel and his excellent report. I thank you for giving me the opportunity to present today and look forward to the discussion and any questions that you might have.
Well, it's great to be back at CSIS, and I just want to start by congratulating both Representative Gingrey and Representative Cooper on their leadership of this Roles and Missions panel, because I think what you've done in this report is to really open up the aperture, to go beyond very important issues of DOD roles and missions, but to really look at what I think are the more fundamental questions, or equally fundamental questions, of U.S. government roles and missions across the interagency. When you look at the kinds of complex operations we're involved in today and that we will be involved in tomorrow, it requires an integrated, coherent whole-of-government approach. And from the end of the Cold War through today, we've had really struggled consistently to achieve that kind of unity of effort. So, much as I'm tempted to comment on DOD roles and missions, because that's kind of where I come from, I'm going to actually focus my remarks on the interagency piece today, because I think the most important roles and missions challenges really lie at this intersection of priority national security missions and those that require a whole of government or integrated approach. The roles and missions report highlighted a number of areas that I would call examples of these sort of key whole-of-government priority mission areas: combating violent extremism, homeland security, counterproliferation, post-conflict reconstruction. And I would add to the list things like counterinsurgency, stability ops, building partner capacity, and so forth. And so what I'd like to do is just take a few minutes to highlight some of the kinds of reforms that I think we need to get at if we're going to have a more integrated approach, and as Representative Gingrey mentioned, the capacity on the civilian side to really support that integrated approach. And I would start, and please, those of you who are veterans of a QDR, don't groan too loudly, but I would start with the idea of a quadrennial national security review. And I don't mean a soup to nuts program and budget review. I really mean a priority setting exercise, that a new administration would come in and would look broadly across national security and really set the president's priorities for the first term. And from that, you could identify priority mission areas and then develop a sort of integrated concept of operations and hopefully even the notion of interagency campaign plans. And on that basis, if you had a vision for here's how we're going to rethink and go after, for example, the challenges associated with violent extremism, you could come up with a concept of operation that's interagency. You could use that to look, to evaluate interagency roles and missions and ask the question, do we have our authorities aligned with our resources, aligned with the responsibilities that we've outlined? And you could actually feed the assessment of that into your budget cycle, ideally. So I think it's very important to kind of step back before we dive in to the particulars to say, do we have a mechanism in place and are we using it to actually set priorities and come up with integrated concepts of operations and plans by which we can then evaluate adjustments in interagency authorities and resources. The second piece is that you've got to have a way of actually translating that into your budgets and your resource allocation. And here I think there has to be a much closer pairing of NSC and OMB. I mean, typically we do our budgeting focused primarily on fiscal guidance from OMB. But what you really need to be also ensuring is that the budget allocation across agencies actually reflects the president's priorities, actually reflects those concepts of operations that you developed in key mission areas. And then you get to the question of capacity. And here I think I would say a couple of things. First of all, we've got to look at how do we create the human foundation for jointness at the interagency level. And here I think we can take a page directly from Goldwater-Nichols and look at the example of how fundamentally that legislation changed the incentive structure for military officers. Suddenly jointness went from being something that might hurt your career because you're out of sight, out of mind of your service where you're going to be promoted, to something you absolutely have to have, joint experience, joint education, to be able to get to flag and general officer. What if we did the same on the civilian side? What if we tied promotion to SES or senior ranks on the civilian side to interagency education, interagency experience, and so forth? Now, to do that, you've actually got to resource the civilian side with a 5 to 10, maybe larger personnel float so that they can actually do the training and rotation without just having managers just take that out of hide. I would also endorse this idea of building capacity on the civilian side, an operational cadre, some active duty, some reserve, some additional contracting authorities. The things I would encourage you all to think about as you go forward with this work is where to put it and how to build it to be successful. I've been a big supporter of SCRS in the State Department, but I've also been very dismayed at watching the sort of institutional antibodies within the State Department bureaucracy kind of be activated and try to kill it. And so I have there's an open question in my mind whether you can grow an operational culture and an operational cadre inside the mother State Department culture, which is not terribly operational in orientation, or whether eventually you will have to create a separate field operating agency that really specializes in recruiting, developing, promoting, retaining civilian operators of various stripes. But the bottom line is this is not only critical for nation building and post-conflict type of situations, but also on the prevention side. If we're going to have a more proactive focus on preventing conflict, shaping the environment, building capacity of others to secure their own areas, we've got to be able to build up some civilian capacity to do that. In the interest of time, let me just start to sum up. I also wanted to applaud you for highlighting the importance of reforming the congressional committee structure. I think you are the first congressional actors ever to have taken the risk of sticking your necks out to say that. That was something that we tried to support with Clark Murdoch in our original BGN work, and I think that was the only recommendation that was met with deafening silence on the Hill. But I think it's absolutely essential. If you actually achieve significant integration on the executive side, and then when you go to resource and support it, you chop it up into little pieces and run it through a stovepipe committee structure, you've really not made as much progress as we would hope. one of the things that I found very interesting in the report is the conditions you laid out for reform based on history. You said we need, first of all, a string of failures, that, you know, some demonstrable illustrations that we have a real problem and it's costing us. You need, you said, a four-star general who can break ranks and lead change. I would say on the interagency level, you actually need a president and or a cabinet secretary who's really going to make this their contribution, their legacy issue. And you said you need at least, you need to be able to overcome the opposition of the uniformed services. I would say now, if you're going interagency, also entrenched agencies and bureaucracies on the civilian side. And finally, you need the Congress that votes in favor of the reform. And here, I think, you know, it's important to recognize, you know, the timing. We're in a presidential election period. Not the most conducive time for a dispassionate discussion of lessons learned from everything from Somalia to Iraq. So I think you are very right in your approach that now is the time to kind of build the intellectual capital, you know, really hone our understanding of the problems, develop options for solution, assess those, and sort of be ready for reform when once we get into a calmer political period where you could have that more dispassionate bipartisan debate. It is my great hope that the next administration will actually take this on as a critical issue, because we as a country cannot afford the costs in lives and treasure not to be able to operate more effectively and with more unity of effort as a whole government. So let me stop there and turn it over to Jim.
Well, thank you for having me. I'd like to extend also my congratulations to both congressmen for really asking a lot of the right questions and putting this on the table in a way I think that it's going to be hard to ignore, if not during this election, then shortly after a new administration takes office next year. I also was struck by those conditions that were laid out for, you know, what allowed, you know, the Goldwater-Nichols reforms to basically take place. And as you said, the string of failures, a defection by a senior military officer, opposition of the services overcome. Congress kind of gets its mojo back in terms of really pushing for reform. And the administration that eventually finally relents to reform. And I actually think, I mean, I covered Goldwater-Nichols was one of the first stories I covered when I came to Washington and took up sort of the defense reporting mantle. And those things are all true. And I sense the same sort of zeitgeist right now in the air as I sensed back then. And I think it's worth going briefly to look at Goldwater-Nichols to see what it accomplished, because it really accomplished most of, I think, probably went beyond in its accomplishments what many people thought that it would achieve. And the string of failures are probably familiar to all of us. Desert One, we saw in great highlight this propensity for the administration, I mean the Pentagon, for when you would have an operation that required sort of a joint operation, to sort of throw ad hoc groups together that had not trained together, that didn't understand each other's cultures and had not a lot of trust in each other, and ask them to do very complex missions. And in this case, you had Marine pilots flying Marine helicopters off Navy ships, transporting Army Special Forces to a desert site, Desert One, where they rendezvoused with Air Force C-130s and a desert site command that was led by an Air Force colonel. You know, and what ensued was the disaster. Servicemen killed. Mission was a high-profile failure. Then you flash forward to Beirut, where you had really a sort of convoluted chain of command that was very slow in realizing that the original mission, which was peacekeeping, had changed on the ground, and those Marines had been perceived by one side as having taken sides in that conflict, and again, disaster leading to the deaths of 241 Marines and a suicide bombing by Hezbollah. And then you flash very quickly to Grenada, and it's the same story once again. We've had a very quick crisis operation. We ask all the services to take part. They are totally incapable of working with each other. Schwarzkopf, in his book, has a famous scene where he's wants to rescue the students because they just found out they were at a different location than anticipated. The Marine Corps pilots would not fly them from the flat tops to the shore, almost got in a fist fight. There was a misapplication of special forces by conventional commanders. It was really just another big snafu, and everyone realized it as such. And very easily could have led to disaster. We almost bombed the barracks where the students were actually being held. A lot of people don't know that. So there was a string of military disasters, and so what happened? You had two generals, and I talked to both of them in writing Prodigal Soldiers about this, you know, why they decided to come out. And it was very unusual for an active four-star general to come out against the system, which he was taking. He was a key node in that system. And both of them pointed to Desert One. They were in the tank together. Back then, they were, you know, the chiefs were really the commanders in charge of the operation. They were, you know, radioing back for orders from to the tank all the way. It didn't, you know, the one thing Goldwater Nichols did was to give the commander-in-chiefs in the field a lot more authority for running operations. But Jones and Myers were both pretty horrified by what happened in the tank that night. And then they had two congressmen in Goldwater's and in Nichols who were willing to buck the system. It was very nice that Goldwater was a Republican and had a Republican administration, because that was cover that a lot of people needed to suggest for really needed reform. And I would say that something else we had then that you might think about was, on both the SASC and the HASC staffs, you had two people who just happened to be very knowledgeable on minutia of military reform, in Jim Locker and Archie Barrett. And I would suggest to you, and I don't know your staffs that well, but it, I mean, having someone like there who understood the issues and could sort of dot the T, cross the T's and dot the I's, was extremely important to Goldwater Nichols moving forward. You had solid think tank work from CSIS and other places, and there was also the, like today, you had this huge acquisition problems. Kat Weinberger was throwing money faster at the Pentagon than it could spend it, and you kept coming up with these stories of, you know, $700 toilet seats and things like this, and $500 hammerheads and things like that. It was kind of a sideshow, but honest to God, a lot of people and a lot of lawmakers who voted on Goldwater Nichols thought they were fixing the $700 toilet problem. And so you have a similar dynamic today where there's so much money being spent on defense. Congress takes notice most when it's funding, because that is your bailiwick. So I think this is a perfect opportunity for Congress to get involved in a serious reform. You know, it's as someone who took part in the recent failures, and we've got, you know, Afghanistan, which was I just returned from recently, and you can see that is sort of strategically stalemated, as General Jones has said. You've got Iraq, where 2006, our string of incompetence and miscalculations almost led to a huge debacle there. And you also had Hurricane Katrina, which I also covered. I shadowed Thad Allen as he tried to get that under control, where you had an absolute breakdown at the federal, state, and local level. And in each of these things, you see the problems now are interagency, as Michelle said. They're not so much within the military so much as they're interagency. You know, I was embedded for that first part, the first 3 weeks of Iraqi freedom, and that's where you could see that Goldwater Nichols had worked. You know, the military playing to their core competencies of conventional warfare were really quite spectacular. And, you know, in 3 weeks, as General Wallace, who I covered, said, you know, they traveled further and fought more decisively than arguably any force we'd ever seen in history. But it was equally clear, you know, as soon as Saddam was gone, that we didn't have the troops to fill the power vacuum, that we had no plan really for Phase 4. The military had spent very little time worrying about Phase 4. And when General Garner showed up, and then after him, Paul Bremer, it was clear that they didn't have a coherent plan for what to do with this country we just invaded and lopped off their regime. So the first place I would focus is this lack of strategic planning. I don't understand, but I think the question has to be asked in your efforts. How do you get to a place where a military who's planning on this thing for a year gets to the penultimate point of success, the toppling of the regime, and has not really planned for Phase 4? How is that possible that was not planned for? I've had it admitted to me from the guys at the very top. We've sort of worried about putting our forces in the right positions, but we were waiting for the, you know, whoever was going to come next, whether it was Garner or Bremer or whoever, tell us what to do. They had no strategic plan for Phase 4. How was it decided at the last minute that the diplomat in charge of that whole effort would be reporting not to the State Department but to the Pentagon, and he then very quickly sort of goes around that communication routes and reports really directly to his handlers in the White House? So a lot of times, you know, you'd ask Rumsfeld, well, what's Bremer doing and why is he doing it? Is Bremer working for me? I mean, he actually said that. He didn't even actually know that Bremer was working for him. And so how does a system create that kind of ad hocery on something so critical as Iraq? I think that's a question that needs to be asked. Despite the lack of sufficient troops, how does the first decision that guy makes be, we're going to abolish the Iraqi army? The military commanders were absolutely against that. How does he make that decision And no one could understand exactly where that decision is coming from. Where is the strategic planning that where that was that idea was vetted and thought through to all its logical conclusions? Once you make that decision, how is it possible that for two to three years, the corollary decision is made, okay, if we're going to abolish the Iraqi army, we've got to stand up a new Iraqi army. No one ever decided to do that. They just sort of did that on, said the army should go ahead and take that out of hide and sort of build up a National Guard. Absolute strategic dereliction of duty. How does the system allow that to happen? I'd like that question answered. I suspect what you'll come back to is some sort of needed reform of the National Security Council. It's the only agency that is responsible for, you know, wringing coherent strategic planning, and someone has to be in charge of execution of that planning over a multi-agency basis. It's not being done now, and if it doesn't get done, you can have all the other reforms that are more grassroots, but they won't work. As has already been stated here, a lot of what is involved in this is really a change for the need for post-conflict nation building. You know, the Bush administration didn't like the idea of nation building, so sort of ignored the logical conclusion of their strategy of regime change, which is you're going to need to sort of rebuild these societies if you want democracies, if you want stable societies that are not going to become sanctuaries. That is, to me, the strategic change in all of this. We need this capability, and it doesn't exist today. You know, I reported from right after the war ended in Baghdad that, you know, those guys were the mayors of Baghdad, and we would go and ask them. The general I was with would ask them, so how are things going? And he said, well, sir, you know, what I need most right now is to know how to turn on, you know, lights for a city of 7 million people, and nothing in my training has ever taught me how to do that. And that's been sort of a metaphor for our whole position in Iraq. We're asking the military to do things it's not been trained to do. They're adjusting very well on the fly, but as the congressman also said, there are things that the military shouldn't do and that don't reside anyplace else in the government, and that has to be fixed. Because this is the world we're going to be looking at. The idea of failed states and failing states becoming sanctuaries, that dynamic is not going away. The report mentions some, I'll start to wind up, some models that I absolutely agree with. The Civil Reserve Corps makes absolutely great sense, you know, building on the lessons of the provincial reconstruction teams. We need to look at joint entities that are very good at fusing the capabilities of multi-agencies. The report mentions the AFRICOM as being a good example of sort of at least the concept. The Counterterrorism Center. I would add the Joint Interagency Task Forces that are set up to fight the drug war. I've visited those. They do a very good job of fusing the capabilities of different agencies. There is a tension between now counterinsurgency and stability operations and conventional operations that any roles and missions study is going to bring to the fore, and it's going to be bloody. I think that it probably is a discussion that has to be had, but it kind of pits the Navy and the Air Force against the Army, Marine Corps and Special Forces, but it's a debate that needs to be had. I share the comment made by Mr. Hamry that if this is handled badly, it'll unleash forces of competition between the services. It'll be negative, and you have to be very careful about trying to avoid that. I also think that it's not primarily about military acquisition. I don't know why acquisition is so resistant to reform, but it is. I'm not sure that's the primary thing, but if it's a $700 toilet seat that gets us the momentum to address this, I think it's a good thing. Finally, on whether the time is ripe, you know, we have the strategic military missteps. You can find plenty of generals right now who are willing to break ranks of the status quo. If you just read the speech from General Sanchez about what Iraq looked like to him, it was a cry for reform. A lot of the generals who came out against Secretary Rumsfeld, and Zinni comes to mind, have been very outspoken about the need to reform in this way. Gates' comment, as has been mentioned, for more money for the State Department is almost a cry for some kind of reform in its own self. And I think the service, you know, this Yingling piece in here points to a dynamic that's not well understood, but a lot of colonels, brigadier generals, lieutenant colonels are coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan. They are agents of change. And there are agents of change and people like Petraeus and others. So I think the services that will not be the opposition they were to Goldwater Nichols. I think they will embrace change in a way that might surprise a lot of people. Congress, again, shows a lot of interest in getting back in the game, if you will, after a period of kind of laissez-faire attitude. And my final comment would be, you know, one thing you'll have to be very careful of is what is needed reform to the system and what is really an example of bad leadership. And, you know, every once in a while I have a little thought process I go to in my editors, and I say, you know, wonder if we'd had all along Powell at State, Gates at Defense, a Scowcroft at National Security Council, would this have looked a lot different? I think it might have, and figuring out what are just bad judgments and what are really institutional problems is going to be a key challenge for you. Thank you.
That's a great introduction to the topic. I do want to open the floor up for questions, and again, we do have roving microphones, so if you raise your hand and you're called on, then please do wait for the microphone. So with that, do we have any questions? Yes, please. General Barno.
Dave Barno at National Defense University. I wanted to take issue a bit with the idea of the civilian reserve corps concept as a means of filling this gap that we have today in our ability to do nation building. One of the interesting observations I heard when I was in Afghanistan from the chief of the UN mission there was, you know, we were having a conversation one day, and he said, you know, one thing that's distinct about this mission from previous nation building tasks is that this is not post-conflict stabilization, nation building, and recovery. It's in-conflict stabilization and nation building. That puts a very different flavor on the context for civilians when they're in a combat environment, when they are the targets of the enemy in many cases, where their actions are the subject of violence from the opposite side. They're not in a humanitarian space anymore, as they like to frame it. They're now on the target set, just like the military is. And it's not because they're in uniform or out of uniform. It's because the conditions of these type of conflicts are not the same as what we typically saw in post-conflict scenarios in the Balkans or in peacekeeping operations in Africa in the 1960s and 70s. This is a different kind of war. So I would challenge you on the idea that we can ask civilians, even though there's great attractiveness to this, and the military certainly doesn't want to be doing these missions. I mean, you'll find almost no one inside the military that says, yes, we need to take this on and do this and do more of it and be more capable. I would argue the opposite. I would say that if we look at what's worked in large-scale reconstructions, for example, Germany and Japan after World War II, a substantial part of that was coming from the military. Military civil affairs, for example, as an organization, as a branch, which is largely reserve component, is built of people that have expertise in these areas. It's a very tiny fraction of a military that's very focused on still combat operations. But that germ of capability allows you to put uniformed people with these civilian expertise sets who do these things often in civilian life into the line of fire. And I don't think looking at the cultures of either non-governmental organizations or, in our case, the State Department, AID, and others, we're ever going to break the mode of putting civilians in the U.S. government who volunteer to go on assignments into the line of fire where they're at risk and they have to act out their missions in combat effectively. So I'd ask you to perhaps think about that and perhaps respond.
Well, you know, there's a good point that you make, and obviously it's a tough situation in Iraq and Afghanistan, and we have what 35 or so of these provincial reconstruction teams that we've stood up more in Afghanistan than in Iraq, but it's a tough thing to do it in this current environment, and that's why, you know, I feel that the model of the African Corps, AFRICORPS, is something that will get us to a point where in the future that we'll have that expertise, that capability, that nation building, if you will, before the fact. Hopefully a conflict of this magnitude won't break out, but I'm not naive enough to assume that we won't have another shooting war 10, 15, 20 years from now. But I think that you're right. It's going to be tough to all of a sudden just throw a civilian reserve corps of people like me in my former life as a physician who maybe volunteer to go over and be part of this reconstruction peacekeeping team, hopefully somewhat protected by the military. But I think eventually that's what we want to get to. And the PRT teams are, you know, we're struggling now because it's hard to get people to volunteer. Maybe we've already talked about it in our opening statements in regard to how you incentivize them and what kind of enhancement to their career track they would achieve by either volunteering or fulfilling their obligation to serve. But I don't think you can look at the current situation and say that this is not possible because there's not enough security there. I think we need to build toward that.
If I could just add, civilian capabilities in a pre-conflict shaping preventative role, where you're trying to build capacity, prevent state failure, or prevent conflict from emerging. And so I think it's really a spectrum of capabilities, and we have to think through multiple different kind of concepts for how these are blended in different kinds of permissive or non-permissive environments.
Next question, Hans Benedek, all the way there in the back.
Thank you, Hans Benendijk. Just first in response to Dave Barno, if you look back at our history, in Vietnam, we did have a cords program. We had a number of civilians involved under military command structures that, in fact, could do the job. It probably does require a shift in culture today. But what I really wanted to do is to shift the discussion a little bit from interagency and post-conflict to the issue of cyber. Cyber. Turn that off for me.
Speaking of cyber.
That was on cue. You mentioned, Congressman Cooper, that there was a paper in your report on the cyber issue. It seems to me this is something that we also have to look at very hard as we think about roles and missions. It is a new and separate domain. We're being attacked in that domain daily. The military has put together a structure to try to deal with it. It has a command that does a lot of things, and one of them is the cyber mission. But underneath that, it looks like spaghetti in terms of the command arrangements. And then so much of this should be a civilian mission as well. So I wonder if you could reflect on how we approach this whole cyber domain. Should we have a cyber corps? How should we structure ourselves as a government to deal with this?
Well, thank you for the question. Three of the last four little essays in the book touch on this important topic. We don't have answers, but we are worried about a lot of things. For example, how do we recruit the brilliant youngsters from MIT or Berkeley who may not want to ever wear any uniform and already have too many tattoos and body piercings to qualify? One facetious suggestion has been that we recruit these people as four-star generals and demote them every year afterwards because that's the way their knowledge works. This is a non-hierarchical challenge that we face. We see ads on TV today of the Air Force saying air, space, cyberspace, basically a land grab for that territory. Then when you talk to the Air Force, they point out carefully that they're only talking about a very limited version of cyberspace, when really the need is not only Pentagon-wide, but it's as broad as it's planetary. Every form of everything that we do is computer-dominated. And when most chips are made in mainland China, and the complexity of this is unimaginable, how can you be a smart enough engineer to understand 4 million transistors on a single chip and a software overlay and how that interacts? there may be only four or five people who are capable of trying to approach that topic. And are they in uniform? I doubt it. Another question is, you can be cashiered for an adulterous affair, but you can infect the entire Pentagon computer system. It's not even a violation of the Uniform Code of Military Justice. So we have to update these things, and part of it's generational. And I'm not faulting anybody, but unless you grew up with these machines, you're not necessarily comfortable in that environment. You know, it's one of these things in a very rigid hierarchical 30 or 40 year progression. You know, we've got a lot of things to grapple with here. So we're trying to raise these questions. We don't know where to put the new cyber corps or if there'd be a cyber corps, but we all must be cyber literate because the very existence of the nation depends on it. The attacks on Estonia last year, the current attacks on the Pentagon, we're already in the cyber war, but we don't want to acknowledge it. And we've got to wake up to this threat fast.
Clark Murdoch.
Clark Murdoch, a senior advisor here, a former HASS staffer, once worked with Mr. Cooper many more years than we want to remember, I think. I was struck by the fact that we've had three presentations here out of the four that really focused on the interagency problem, yet the Congress mandated that the Department of Defense do a roles and missions review. And if the answer is that was your jurisdiction, that's part of the problem, not part of the solution.
Amen, amen, amen. But we have to play under existing rules. We're doing the best we can, and behind the scenes, a lot is going on in Congress today with broader committee discussions. So I think you're going to see some very exciting and interesting things. The winds of change are here, folks. And we have already had meetings that I'm not at liberty to discuss that would be considered earth-shaking in a previous time. People are seeing similarities, they're seeing needs. So I think James or Michelle had it right. This is very much like that period of ferment in the early 1980s. And sometimes change, particularly if James is right, if this robustness of the colonels and the majors and the captains is being felt, change could happen faster than we think.
If I could just add, I think there are a lot of DOD roles and missions issues embedded in some of these, you know, larger interagency areas. And let me take one example. Anytime we do post-conflict reconstruction, if we're doing building capacity, the whole question of the train and equip and advising, assisting kind of mission. Traditionally, a soft area of expertise in because of the size and scope of the mission in a place like Iraq, you're having conventional army forces do a great deal of that. The whole sorting out of what part of that future mission area is SOF, what part of it is big army, what part of it is Marine Corps, has pretty profound implications on how you allocate the growth, the growth of the Army and the Marine Corps and the growth of SOF. And I was just mentioning before we started, I've heard one chief say that SOF has told him they've got it, so basically butt out. I've heard another chief say, SOF is divesting itself of this mission so it can do more direct action, so we got it. And I've heard Admiral Olson say, no, this, you know, yes, we're in this, but we need help from others. So, I mean, I think there's some pretty fundamental DOD issues embedded in some of these larger missionaries that needed to be sorted out. That's just one example.
Yeah.
Let me, if I could, raise one even more fundamental question. I don't know if you sense a growing isolationism, protectionism around the country, but I think increasingly people will be asking if we can afford trillions of dollars for various missions. You know, we're on our sixth or seventh Muslim nation we've tried to repair in the last 15, 20 years. You know, more and more back home Americans, not at CSIS, will be saying, what the hell are we doing over there? So we got to get real on that issue, too.
And Congressman Cooper, that's more or less my question. Mark Peterson from Department of Defense. We talked about Phase 4 and the stability operations, but a lot about post-conflict. I noticed Tom Barnett's article in there about the Americans have landed, and he starts with his first sentence, nation building is what we need to do, and yet that is becoming the four-letter word in our country, on both sides of the aisle, I believe, Republican and Democrat. This is going to require a huge amount of resources, not necessarily just in the Department of Defense, but across the agencies. Do you think that there will be the political will after the elections to put in the budgets for that nation building?
When Jim and I rolled out this report last week, a very similar question came up. And as we all know in this room, that at this point we've spent about $750 billion of offline spending, if you will, emergency supplemental for Iraq and Afghanistan. Hopefully, at some point in the near future, that $10 billion a month burn rate will decrease fairly rapidly with honor and hopefully victory. And then, you know, we've hopefully got some money that we can shift around for just these very things that we need to delay or maybe even avoid, at least delay, the next major shooting war. And $750 billion is a lot of money that would be very helpful to the State Department and USAID and the buildup of interagency capability to do the things that we're talking about here today and in the report.
It's currently so small that we could have revolutionary change there for pennies on the dollar in Pentagon terms. I get in trouble for thought experiments, but if you were to divide $750 billion or whatever the number is, because it's headed fast toward a trillion or plus, by the population of those countries, remembering that a school teacher in Iraq, before we went in, made, what, $40 a month or something? You know, it's just astonishing, you know, what we've done. And, you know, it's sometimes we don't think of things in those terms. I was long convinced that a good grocery store in downtown Moscow would have collapsed the Soviet regime faster than anything. Because these folks grew up not having any idea about what capitalist abundance was like. They thought it was all a trick or a game. So we sell ourselves so poorly around the world. We have never been held in lower esteem, and we've never been a better nation. You know, what's this gap? We've got to figure out a way to sell for what we're worth, and we're not doing it today. I'm stunned. Most Americans have no idea we have troops in about 120 nations every night. Granted, many of these are very small presences, but still, that reach and the fact that our defense budget equals every other nation's defense spending combined, you know, people have no idea about this. But in a recession, in tougher economic times, they're going to start asking questions, especially with 100. Goldman Sachs is on the radio today predicting $150 a barrel oil or $200 a barrel. This is getting to be a little bit of a populist, you know, time. So we don't know what the new president will be like, but the fundamental pressures are there.
I'm going to go ahead and interject my own question. The perspectives volume itself is quite far-reaching in terms of the range of missions it covers, but we focused most of the conversation today, probably quite understandably, on the issue of post-conflict reconstruction and overseas missions. I do want to ask particularly the members, but any of the panelists, to talk a little bit about this issue of homeland defense and homeland security, because it seems to me the area where the public, and that particularly in a populist time, that the public sentiment might really come to push roles and missions across the government and within DOD in ways that perhaps aren't as helpful as if we were thoughtful about them. So I'm wondering how much attention is being paid, both in your panel but in your committee, to roles and missions as they relate to homeland defense.
I don't know how many of you noticed last summer we had a hearing on the simple but absolutely vital question of who is in charge of stopping a nuclear attack on the homeland. The answer to that question is so mind-bogglingly complex. Nobody understands it. Now, you, especially you military folks, can give a good answer about CIA overseas or NORTHCOM or FBI, or that's not good enough. And we must be able to answer that question, not only in clear terms, but effective action. And you know, one of the many things outside our jurisdiction is the FBI anti-terrorism efforts, but read General Odom's book called Fixing Intelligence. You won't sleep for 3 days. It's amazing what's out there and what needs to be looked at. So our first and most important duty is to protect the homeland. And there's a lot of doubt today that we're doing that effectively.
Well, one of the things that the 9/11 Commission report called for was to maybe have some jointness in the committee structure in regard to the respective select committees on intelligence, and maybe even the same joint budget authority of those respective appropriations committees. That's not something that we've done. We've done a lot of things that the 9/11 Commission report called for. In fact, standing up the Director of National Intelligence and trying to get away from some of the stovepiping and make sure that we know where the dots are so that we can connect the dots. So I think we do have more work to do in regard to homeland defense and homeland security. I mean, it's just not enough to throw 22 agencies under the same roof and expect it to operate efficiently. So, I think we definitely have more work to do in that area.
Charlie Stevenson Seiss, another question for the congressman. It seems to me that what the executive branch is asking for in a lot of these areas is more resources and more flexibility in spending them, which goes right to Congress's power of the purse. Is there a way of persuading Congress to be flexible? And if so, what's the bargain? Is there a grand bargain where you get greater accountability, such as through confirmation of the head of the National Security Council staff or something like that? Is there a way of crafting a grand bargain?
Don't tempt us with that last idea there. As much waste and problem as there is in DOD, if you compare that to some other sectors, such as, for example, healthcare, read this book called Overtreated by Shannon Brownlee. It's brand new. It's based on very sound data from Dartmouth over 30 years. And that book claims that we are probably wasting every year between $500 and $700 billion. And much of that money is not only wasted, it actually harms our health. So this is not a slender journalistic speculation here. Now, we don't know how to root out all of that waste, but that's equal to the entire DOD budget. In DOD's worst days or years, it's never conceived of wasting that much money, and yet we do that routinely in healthcare. So there are resources if we reorganize a lot of government, but it's going to take a lot of more understanding, a lot of political will. We really haven't redesigned government since the Great Society or the New Deal. That's essentially the larger roles and missions task. As giant as this job is, we really need to take on the whole enchilada. And people in this room, people in Washington, people across the country can be helpful in that, because many government programs don't work very well, and many congressmen don't know even what those programs are. We've already seen the embarrassment of not knowing the difference between Sunni and Shia. Many congressmen don't know the difference between Medicare and Medicaid. There are huge challenges, including rebuilding the civil service, that we need to undertake. So this is the most exciting time in American history to be part of this effort to restructure, rebuild what is already the greatest country on earth, but which faces challenges to that greatness. Because when you're number one, everybody's shooting at you, even your friends. And we can see pretty clearly some paths to preserving our greatness, if not enhancing that greatness. That's what we should be focusing on. But lots of folks have gotten distracted. We on the Hill have gotten distracted with fundraising and earmarks and things like that. The real job of legislation and governing is often neglected. But we can reclaim that. We must reclaim that. And that's, so as big as roles and missions is, there's even more work to do.
Jim, I'm going to read that book, Overtreated. It should be required reading for an MD member of the Congress. And no question that in healthcare there is so much overtreatment and spending way too much on the latest bells and whistles technology, if you will. And I'll give you a perfect example. I'm not a cardiologist, but a couple of years ago, CMS decided to agree to cover the cost of a defibrillator in any Medicare patient who had any history of coronary artery disease, even though that patient had never had an arrhythmia to cause them to be in a life-threatening situation. And so, you know, the invasive cardiologists were all too happy to, I think, to insert those defibrillators in all comers at about $35,000 per clip. So I'm looking forward to reading the book, Overtreated. My staff needs to go immediately, and I'll get that from the Library of Congress. But surely you can apply the same thing to the military budget. I mean, you know, we're talking about getting close to $600 billion a year now, not counting any emergency spending. And Jim and I have talked about this. I mean, you know, I don't certainly maybe getting on a little thin ice here, and I don't want to get out of my lane, but when you look at the way the money is distributed among the services, over a long period of time, and there's maybe a 1 or 2% variation in how much you're spending, surely there are times when maybe that should be dramatically different. Maybe at some period of time the Air Force should get most of the money. At some period of time the Navy should get most of the money. At some period of time the Army should get most of the money, depending on what your needs are. So, Jim, I'll let you maybe, if you want to elaborate on that, because I am definitely getting out of my lane here pretty quickly. But we need to be the oversight can't be overstated, the importance of that, hugely important.
Just keeping with the medical analogy, I mean, it seems to me right now we have analogous to having people treated in the emergency room. By sending in the military, you're really waiting until the emergency room moment. And that's hugely inefficient. I think the idea, if you look at what's happening in Afghanistan or Iraq or what we're doing in any of these nation-building enterprises, is to sort of phase the military out, phase ourselves out, but leave in place sufficient capability from the local government and forces to do the job themselves. And so it should be a declining spending curve that allows you to not go in with that hugely expensive military operation that is really an emergency room sort of operation. So I think the best argument to be made for this on a money sort of way is, you know, money spent on standing up local security forces is money that we won't have to spend sending our own security forces, which is dramatically more expensive. You know, the Afghan defense minister told me, you know, for one price of one NATO soldier, we could field 70 or 80 soldiers. So that's the idea, is efficiencies so we can avoid doing the emergency room type stuff because it's very expensive.
Okay, I'd like to do two more questions. Are there more questions out there? Yeah, please, all the way back here.
Matt Towle from CRS. I was sitting alongside James Kitfield at the press table for Goldwater Nichols, and it strikes me, in some respects, you have taken on a job that's simpler. There were three characteristics to the political situation in Goldwater Nichols that we're not up against now, I think. And the first was that everyone understood that the joint versus services tug of war was the naval services versus the rest of the known world. I mean, it was like that through most of the 20th century. And everybody understood that was the fundamental dynamic. The second factor was that basic schism happened to overlay the division between the two armed services committees for various reasons, mostly idiosyncratic. Senate Armed Services was, let's say, highly responsive to the naval services point of view. And the third thing was we had a Secretary of Defense and an immediate supporting staff that was as hostile to congressional initiative as anyone other than perhaps some more recent Secretary of Defense had been. And you don't have any of that. We've already bailed the cat of the service versus the joint institutions, and it's not clear to me that any of the services, whether the naval services or the others, should feel any of their prerogatives particularly threatened by what the type of thing you're talking about. Secretary Gates and Secretary England, I mean, they're certainly in your corner. I don't mean to understate the scope of the problem you're taking on, but there were some profound political obstacles that 20 years ago were faced, and I'm not sure that you have them. That's more a comment than a question.
I think you're exactly right, and people should not be discouraged. But on the other hand, you know, as great as Phil Gingrey is, he's not Barry Goldwater, and I'm not Bill Nichols. You know, sometimes it takes a particular magic of personality and committee position in Congress to get things done. Most of our colleagues are still almost blissfully unaware of these issues. So we have a lot of missionary work to do on the Hill and with various groups. And you might not think the services are sensitive today. Believe you me, we're hearing from all of them. And they think they're as sensitive as they were in the 80s.
And last question right here.
It's both the comment and the question. Reading the small section on AFRICOM, I'm Bob Hudak. I was a Foreign Service Officer for 35 years, serving mainly in Africa, and then another 10 years as the National Intelligence Officer for Africa until I retired a couple months ago. And I'm troubled by the treatment in here of AFRICOM, because I think it gets a number of things wrong, and actually would like to commend to you outstanding paper that Kathleen and Steve Morrison and Mark Bellamy have just issued here at CSIS on where AFRICOM should go. It's incredibly diplomatic.
I always plant the last question.
But it's very, very thoughtful, because the problem that I saw in your report saying, do we want this to be just another combatant command? After 45 years of service in Africa, yeah, I want it to be a combatant command. I want these to be the smartest guys around dealing with Africa. And the original idea of consolidating elements of three different commands into a new command was a good idea. But I think it's been badly handled, even starting with the effort to locate in Africa, which is a no-go with the Africans, and has hurt the command. I'll take it one step further. At a time that we are closing military bases in the United States to spend billions of dollars to build up a headquarters from them in Germany, makes no sense at all. I mean, there's only one military command that's not based in the United States, and that's because we beat the Germans in World War II and there was a thing called NATO. And when you think of what the force protection costs are of locating overseas, and I guarantee that there will never be a country in Africa that can provide what Germany is providing to us now. But I'll even go further. What is the cost? We know what the euro is at right now, of establishing in Germany, when it can be right here in the United States. Now, even your pamphlet says that in Kenya we have a precursor of what this could be. I think you're referring to CJTF HOA, which is 1,800 military guys sitting on a salt pan in Djibouti. CJTF HOA was set up mainly because at the time we were scared of an outflow of the terrorists out of Iraq. That never came to pass. Wasn't bad in terms of anticipating. And when it didn't come to pass, they started looking for a mission. 1,800 guys that are drilling maybe two or three wells a month, painting a few schoolhouses. This is not the most cost-effective way of doing development or humanitarian assistance in Africa. And the effort of DOD to paint AFRICOM as the new softer side of the Pentagon just doesn't go down, because we will engage in kinetic actions. We just did it over a week ago. And when it happens, there's going to be a reaction from the African standpoint, which is another one of the arguments of why we shouldn't be headquartered on the continent. The continent is fragile. When you look back at the major military involvements, whether it was Wheelis Air Force Base, Kagnu Station in Ethiopia, all it takes is a Colonel Mengistu or a Gaddafi, and now billions of dollars are gone overnight, or even Liberia with a Sergeant Doe or a President Taylor. So I would urge you to read the CSIS paper. I think it's a good analysis of the situation, and it's not a totally negative one, but I think it points us in the right direction of how we should go with Africa. Thank you.
Well, I welcome your comments. This is exactly the sort of input that we're looking for, because this is an ongoing learning experience. And I would just like to ask you to do one thing. Unretire. We need your expertise. Don't let it go, man. Yeah, thanks.
I'd like to ask my staff, get me that CSIS paper as well as that book on overtreated.
Any final comments down the line here on AFRICOM or other examples of interagency reform before we close? Well, thank you all very much for coming today.